to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. In Ireland, England, and Philadelphia, citizens are moving forward, scoring notable victories for public interest banking and the reclamation of public control of our money. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, here once again with a look at what's happening with the money power on our planet. This week, we'll take a look at another positive public banking development in the U.S., and Ellen talks with a couple of protagonists in England and Ireland who describe the path that they're walking to get public banking footholds underway. Their process has lessons to teach us all about what it takes to face off against those with hands on the levers of financial power. One such example is in Iceland that Ellen and I discussed as a lesson of what can go wrong with public initiatives.
The program this week is focusing on the struggle, really, around the world that people are making, and with some success, toward creating their own banks in replacement for the abandonment of local economies by the corporate banking interests. And we've seen some really exciting stuff happen. You know, the Philadelphia initiative is very big, of course, right on the heels of the Santa Fe City Council supporting and issuing a very positive feasibility study. We're seeing around the world other economies where people are trying to take a stand to reclaim control of their money. And in Iceland, there's been a process there that seems to have been thwarted. Can you bring us up to date on that?
In Iceland, I'll be speaking in Iceland the weekend after next, so I'll find the real lowdown. But I've seen emails that Icelanders have forgiven all their mortgage debt. It's not true. Unfortunately, it's just not true. They had an amazing pots and pans revolution where they actually won. I mean, the people, their corrupt conservative government was overthrown for the time being, and the left wing got in. They chose to run for office. And then they had a referendum where they actually changed the constitution, and it was done by committee that was chosen at random of people who were not representing a political party but actually just spoke their minds, you know, spoke what they were thinking, spoke their consciences. And apparently they came out with a beautiful piece of work, but the legislature refused to ratify it. And now the conservatives have gotten back in, so they have another corrupt government. I mean, it's the same interests are now in control. And unfortunately, we've seen that around the world. That's what happened in Greece, where the Syriza party was elected with a mandate to oppose austerity and to basically stand up to the big banks. But they lost because it's not really a political issue. I saw that Yanis Varoufakis has a TED Talk out where that's basically the theme of the TED Talk, is that you can get your politicians elected, but it may not do any good because the politicians aren't in control. It's the people who control the economy who are in control, which you could read that as the bankers, the central banking cartel monopoly that pretty much rules the world. Just as a side note, I was shocked to read that the real reason for invading Libya was not what we've been told. It wasn't really a humanitarian thing. It was really to prevent Libya from establishing its own currency in Africa that would compete with the Western banking system. Well, that was actually admitted in these emails, that Hillary Clinton emails that are so controversial.
Oh, really?
In one of the emails, they came out and said that's what it was all about. And that was the reason that France was in there, was to try to protect their interests, their currency as the dominant currency in that part of Africa.
In listening to your interview earlier, those people talked about how the bankers are positioned to vacuum up some of the best assets in Ireland and in the UK, as we've seen in Greece and Cyprus, and Puerto Rico is positioned for that, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we have the same crowd of greedy bankers doing their work everywhere in the world.
Yeah, and in Iceland, the banks were actually nationalized right up till the very end of the 20th century. And then they were privatized. And immediately, within a few years, they had this huge banking crisis because they did all these corrupt gambling type things, you know, where they were leveraging their credit and they got involved in all these foreign things like collateralized debt obligations. And the banks crashed. So you would think the natural solution would be, let's just nationalize banks again. But they didn't. What they did was they put them through bankruptcy and they set up some new banks, which are also privatized. So it seems to me it's like what Yanis Varoufakis said, that it's not the politicians who are in control, it's the people who control the money. And that means the bankers, and therefore the solution, the only way to get that system back is we have to get the banks back. As they say in Iceland, once you get a foot in the door, you really have to be organized, move in, and change the system while we have the chance.
A couple of milestones have been reached in recent weeks in the progress of creating new American public banks. One of them, as we've discussed previously, was in Santa Fe, where a very positive feasibility study indicated that that city could save millions of dollars in financing costs in the near term, and the other just last week in the Philadelphia City Council, as it unanimously agreed to proceed with hearings to examine how a public bank in that major U.S. city could work. Here are some of the reasons that the council resolution included. That the creation of a public bank could offer the possibility of achieving multiple policy objectives, including stimulating economic development, spurring job creation, reducing municipal debt service, expanding the tax base through direct long-term local lending at below-market rates, and that a public bank could partner with community banks to extend reliable, affordable credit to small businesses and other community stakeholders. And that the profits from a public bank could be split between public and private interests and reinvestment in the bank's local investment portfolio, while the capitalization of local commercial corridors and small businesses would foster citywide benefits to citizens, neighborhoods, and the school district, and that a public bank could facilitate additional goals, such as citizen inclusion in setting investment priorities and hiring preferences for local vendors, and so forth. Clearly, an impressive list of reasons why this city, and now scores of others around the U.S., are considering public banks. So let's talk now with Mike Krause, the founder of the Pennsylvania Project and a founding board member of the Public Banking Institute, who's been working on this project for several years.
What is the significance of the city council voting to open hearings now on a public bank?
Well, Walt, Philadelphia is the fifth largest market in the United States, and it has a storied place in American history. And our thinking was that if we get this moving in Philadelphia, it's going to attract attention and encourage other cities to do the same thing. Now, you know that Santa Fe, New Mexico, is actually out in front. They started this process 6 months ago. They concluded the study, feasibility study. The study says this is a great idea. It laid out some of the benefits. And that study was accompanied by an independent study that reached the same conclusions. So there's a lot of information and evidence out there now that indicates this is a solid proposal. We think the biggest impact will be it's going to transform municipal finance. You know, right now, Walt, every year, every city, every town in America, budget time, oh, it's awful. And what can you do? Well, you can lay off, which adds unemployment. You can cut services. You can ask for employee givebacks. You can take on more debt or raise more taxes. This is a tool that adds to prosperity and doesn't subtract from prosperity, and gives cities and towns some breathing room. One of the big impacts may be, or sure is, as a matter of fact, that the bank can refinance existing municipal debt at below market rates, or just offer loans for new municipal purposes. As, for example, in North Dakota, the bank there provided a $48 million loan at below market to a local school district to build a new school. So many cities and towns are drowning in debt. This will help relieve some of that debt, take the pressure off taxpayers, and give municipal finance officers some room to maneuver.
So in addition to the work that you and the Pennsylvania Project has been doing, what kind of political support have you found to be able to bring it this far through council considerations?
Well, it's pretty broad. First of all, this may be the only thing that the occupiers and the Tea Parties can agree upon. We find both groups very supportive of this concept. You can see why Occupy likes it. It localizes control of money. It shoves a little bit of Wall Street out of the way, makes our cities less dependent on Wall Street financing and debt to get things done. And the Tea Parties look at this and say, well, this is local control of local money for local purposes, no Washington involved, what's not to like? So we're finding a rather broad support, of course.
And the politicians, if you will, what are their objectives?
Well, you to understand that, you need to read the resolution passed by Philadelphia City Council. It's real clear where they think this can go. One, there's an impact on debt service. There's no question about that. They talk about economic development of main corridors. That means neighborhood development, getting lower-cost money into the neighborhoods of Philadelphia for perhaps recovering some of the vacant properties, mortgages to residents, to rehab, to go to energy efficiency, solar energy. A lot of the banks, you know, don't want to lend $40,000, $60,000 to an individual. They'd rather loan to some developer, you know, for 20 lots at $800,000. You know, you push the same amount of paper, you make more money that way. It's less overhead. We also see the resolution indicating relief to the schools. These banks make profits. Those profits can be dedicated, and one likely target for the dedicated funds is, of course, in cities like Philly, the schools. So this is a revenue generator that doesn't require taxes. It can lower municipal debt. That's a good thing. It can target affordable credit and do areas that the city government wants to target for economic development and jobs creation.
And, of course, new ideas always have pushback. The first thing that happens with a new idea is it gets pushed back on a crazy person who thinks that's a good idea. What kind of experience have you been having with that so far?
All across America, one of the biggest concerns is going to be, oh, my God, you're going to give politicians some money. Please don't do that. You hear that everywhere. There is a high level of mistrust of public officials. That's certainly true in Philadelphia. It's true in many other cities. But we're not proposing to give any politician a bank. Politicians have banks now. They're called these different authorities. They're staffed by politicians, they're run by politicians, and they loan within the political process. They're just drowning in political implications, whereas a bank run by professionals is apart from the political process. So we've got political lending now. This is not political lending. This is private lending. We're putting the public funds in the hands of professionals. So governance is key. How you set this up, as they did in North Dakota, how you make sure that bankers and not politicians run this bank, that is absolutely key. And there's no question about that.
Well, speaking of the bankers, what about the private banking industry? What kind of feedback have you been getting from them? What's that process look like?
Well, you know, our project in Pennsylvania does have two highly qualified banker advisors with broad experience in the industry, and they think this is a great idea. So what we're finding is the industry initially looks at that and says, oh, my goodness, you're going to get involved in banking. Government shouldn't be involved in that. That's a terrible idea. That's the knee-jerk reaction. But what we have to do and have been doing is we get to the bankers, we sit them down and say, look at what happened in North Dakota. The banks there, as you know, Walt, love the Bank of North Dakota. They think it helps them keep business, keep the Wall Street banks out, partners with them to make more loans, bigger number of loans, dollar amount, that is to say. So in North Dakota, the experience has been universally positive. So we just need to share that. And as we do, people go, oh, I see. This isn't a competitor. It's an assist to my local bank.
And so what are the next steps at this point? What does the process look like?
Well, in Philadelphia, we meet in a week or so with city council staff, and we'll lay out that process. First will be hearings. And I think after hearings, there will be a resolution of some kind to move forward. And that's another process. You know, you don't just say, well, let's have a bank. In Pennsylvania, as in most states, you've got to get a charter from the state banking authorities to open that bank. That's a long process. Now, our bank advisors have been through that process, by the way. They've actually started banks and know how this works. And we've been meeting regularly with the banking department of in our state capital to scope this process out. So there are a number of questions that have to be resolved. The people of Philadelphia, through their elected officials, have to define the mission of the bank. That's number one. It's broad, of course, you know, economic development, jobs creation, debt service reduction, all that kind of stuff. But they may have targeted mission within a broader mission, and that could change from year to year. Second step then is, where's the capital come from? We think we know where it is. Cities like Philadelphia have tons of pension funds. They are not performing well. They come with huge fees and commissions for poor performance, and we're saying take a piece of your pension portfolio, and instead of investing in a Scandinavian hedge fund, take an equity position in the bank as a kind of investment, which gets good returns. BND posts 17 to 25% on equity year in, year out. Those are rather good returns. Third is the deposit base. Banks have to have deposits. We are saying take some portion of the city's deposits, which in any given day are $500 million, take them out of the Wall Street banks, which charge huge fees to manage those funds, put them in your own bank. They're more secure. They're not exposed to a derivatives meltdown, for example, and you'll lower your cost of doing banking, which is another savings for the city. Then you get to what I said earlier was the big question, governance. How do you set it up so that it's accountable to political authority, representing the people, but not managed by political authority? That's a big deal. Then you get the other normal questions of, you know, of risk management and transparency. But we think those are no-brainers. With a public bank loan, first you must pass muster at your local bank with their existing underwriting standards. Then and only then do you approach the public bank for its participation. So you get a double analysis of the risk, which is one reason why the BND has such a low default ratio. So we think that's actually a no-brainer. And then transparency. This is a public institution. It will be publicly audited. It will also be overseen by the Pennsylvania Banking Department, which does a really good job, actually. And people say, well, that, you know, can they understand what your bank is doing? Well, I mean, you know, go get your annual statement for Wells Fargo, and you tell me you know what's being said there, please. You know, these banks have thousands of subsidiaries. No one knows what's going on. That's how the London Whale melted down. J.P. Morgan never saw it coming, and they lost $8 billion. The next loss could be $40 billion. No, we need public money publicly audited and professionally managed by bankers and not gamblers.
And finally, Mike, what role will the people play in the process of getting this banking matter considered?
That's a good question. What is being proposed in Philadelphia is, along with the professional bankers who will manage the bank, there will be some kind of citizen advisory committee that would advise the government on how it alters mission from year to year. You know, I mentioned earlier that one mission might be affordable mortgages into neighborhoods so individuals can acquire some of the many thousands of vacant homes in Philadelphia, rehab them for a home, for a business, for whatever, and go energy efficient and sustainable, put solar in there. That's one thing. Some other year, it could change. For example, the Bank of North Dakota last year was instructed by the legislature to move into the high-tech medical facilities industry. They're doing that. The legislature said, we want you to do something about student loans. So the BND is offering to consolidate the student loans of every student in North Dakota from whatever source at lower interest and a longer payment term. So that's the kind of thing a bank can do. It can year to year be advised by the citizens working through their legislators or their city council members, whichever it is, to alter or direct or redirect the bank's mission from year to year within the overall overarching goal of economic development, job creation, non-tax revenue, and lower debt service.
Well, Mike, we're going to obviously be following this with a great deal of attention and congratulate you on getting it this far. It's really a huge accomplishment to get them.
This has been, Walt, a team effort, first of all. And secondly, this is the way it has to work. This is bottom up. This is how things really do need to work. We need to engage people where they live, solving the problems they confront in ways that work for them. We don't need solutions imposed from outside, frankly. There's lots of talent in America. Lots of assets, tremendous diversity. We just need to enable that diversity. And we think that's what public banking does. It's a tool to enable diversity. And the results will be different from place to place to place, but they'll all be positive.
That's Mike Krause, the founder and chair of the Pennsylvania Project, which recently completed a milestone in the successful passing of a city council resolution to begin hearings on the creation of a Philadelphia City Public Bank. And And now let's join Ellen as she talks with a couple of people in England and Ireland about their pursuit of creating public banks in their hometowns.
I'm speaking today with two charming public banking activists from the other side of the pond, or one of the ponds, Eimear O'Shuachrú in Ireland and Marie McCary in England. Eimear is an architect and surveyor in Dublin, where she was one of the founders of FASTA, the Foundation for the Economics of Sustainability. She is director of EOS Future Design, which designs and develops sustainable systems and settlements. She has also been instrumental in getting public banking on the map in Ireland. Marie is the local coordinator for the Positive Money Group in Bradford, England, and hosts a Bradford community radio program on alternative economics called Why Don't Economists? She is also one of the organizers of a conference in Manchester on public banking on February 20th, where I'll be speaking along with Professor Richard Werner and some other very interesting speakers. So it's great to be talking to you, Eimear and Marie.
Great to be on the show.
So, Eimear, we interviewed you, I think, a year ago on the public banking movement in Ireland, and it really seems to be taking off. So I wondered if you could go into that. I guess you have five political parties that are advocating public banks in your upcoming elections.
Well, it's really four that we can be sure of. But I really shouldn't claim credit for the work in the last year. It's very much Noel Kinahan who started with me and others. But Noel made a great partnership with Irish Rural Link. And Irish Rural Link is a network organization. It's a network of all the community development organizations in the country. And Seamus Boland, who heads it up, is a great political operator and a really nice guy. And between the good idea of local public banks and the support of the Sparkassen Foundation from Germany, and then linked with Irish Rural Link's network and Seamus Boland's political kind of nous, the whole idea has got legs. And it's now part of the manifesto for the new election. You know, they're going to be calling an election very shortly in Ireland. So Sinn Féin, it's very much part of their manifesto. It's center stage in the Green Party's manifesto. The new Social Democrats as well have included a piece on local public banks, not as detailed, but it's there. And Renew, which is a kind of more right-wing small party that has started up, they've also included it in their policies if they get elected. So it's definitely on the map now. The only problem is that the main parties in power at the moment, Fine Gael and Labour, and the other main party, Fianna Fáil, they haven't put it into their manifesto, although Seamus and Noel are still working on them.
And could you describe your political system there? Like, you could get several parties in, right?
That's right. We've got proportional representation, so your vote is never wasted. And elections are great fun. You can, you know, you vote your first choice, your second choice, your right down to your tenth choice. And it's brilliant. So if your guy doesn't get in, they count the second preferences of his or hers, and then they allocate it to the other candidates and so on. And then they see if they've got a threshold. They get over the threshold, then they're elected. So the counts can go on for 2 days. So it means that small parties have a chance and independents have a chance. And this election is full of small parties and independents.
Well, how many parties do you have?
Well, last count, about six or seven.
And Marie, you're sort of on the ground floor in the UK with public banking. You and Bob Grono are organizing a public banking conference on February 20th. Do you want to go into that and how you got into it and what prompted you to set up a public banking conference?
It's quite a story, really, because I'm from Manchester, which is in Lancashire, which is the oldest industrial town. And Manchester has gained a devolution. It's not a people-powered devolution. It's about Manchester gaining powers to supply more services.
Can you define what you mean by devolution?
England's a very centralized country, very, very centralized. Everything mm-hmm. is done from London. The local authorities don't have a lot of power, really, and a lot of money, really. So we get very little, but not really doing anything. So the main thing, it's a political thing, so that people would then blame the local administration for the services declining rather than the central government not providing enough money. So I was going to these conferences and kept putting my hand up and saying, we don't have to depend on London for money. We could have local public banking and generate our own money, et cetera, you know. And people were listening to me and going, oh, that sounds really good, you know, yeah, yeah. But the panel of experts on the front would just ignore it, basically, and it was driving me nuts.
So, yeah, I'm noticing there's just a huge interest all of a sudden. I mean, people know that the current system is not working and we need something else.
And there's another crash on the way and we need to have something on the table, you know, that's not private banking, not the same, you know, that's completely and utterly different.
And, yeah, we need something for safety and we need something to generate money, yeah.
Well, it's great having the internet because the newspapers just don't have the power anymore, really, to shape people's opinions, you know. They can so many people can see through all the, you know, distortions and lies.
Right. I think that's our hope, that that's what's different about this century compared to, say, the populist movement of the 1890s, where they had to rely on word of mouth and local newspapers. And now we've got this amazing tool that where things can go viral, like literally viral.
Yeah,
all over.
But if you look at the level of debate that was going on at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries about social credit and banking, it was very high level.
Right, but they just didn't get it out there. But, yeah, I agree. They were a lot more savvy than we are. The farmers were more savvy than we are.
Yeah.
We have a strong credit union movement in Ireland. That was our kind of contribution to alternative banking systems. But, unfortunately, even though I think we have the highest level of participation in credit unions in Europe or in the developed countries, it's very much consumer credit and very much a sort of a voluntarily run set of organizations. And they didn't kind of adjust to the new challenges of the recent times. And they've got very much sidelined. But because credit unions are so much part of our society, I think local public banks seem doable, certainly down in rural areas. And the rural areas have lost their post offices. The big banks have moved out of the towns. And people can't do their business anymore. And that's how Irish Rural Link got involved. They were trying to keep the banks in rural areas and not succeeding. And then when Noel arrived with the idea of local public banks and that the Sparkasm Foundation would actually help Irish people to set up local banks and that they could supplement and support the credit union movement, it was a marriage made in heaven, and the groups immediately got the idea. The thing is to get it into the public press. It's very difficult to get it into mainstream media.
Well, what I find interesting about what's happened in Ireland is that it's you talking to the politicians of these smaller parties, and there's not really a groundswell of opinion underneath happening yet. You know, maybe it will happen now with the...
It's different in Ireland because we're a small country and everybody knows everybody else. And I often think we don't need to do much, you know, like I have 57 first cousins. And, you know, when you start networking, you know people. And that's how things happen in Ireland. And you may not be on the streets, but you're in an organization. It could be a local residence group and they're aware of it, or a local community development group in a rural area. And they're linked with other community groups or voluntary groups or charitable groups, of whom there are many, many in Ireland. And that's how a lot of change happens, at grassroots levels, not necessarily on the street, but on those civil society organizations that are still very strong. And then you can get the ear of politicians. In Ireland, you can meet, you know, the Minister for Finance or the Taoiseach relatively easily. I think, Ellen, you met our Taoiseach when we were over there. We just bumped into him.
Uh-huh.
And you can do that in Ireland. So it's a different kind of political world. Now, that's not to say that there haven't been marching. You know, there's marching about paying water charges. And it's been a big mobilization. But there's no sign, really, that much change has occurred. We've probably got further working with civil society, networked grassroots people, with local public banks, than the more conventional mobilization of left-wing groups against the water charges.
I agree. That's the stage we're at now. We, in the U.S., we had Occupy Wall Street, which was, you know, a huge movement where people took to the streets and got everybody's attention. But now what we need is organization, and we need to get all these different groups working for different things sort of under one umbrella, like something that we all agree on. I mean, one thing we all agree on, if we are following in the footsteps of Occupy Wall Street, is that Wall Street has failed, and that we need to substitute something. You know, we need another system. What we might not agree on what that is, but if we could just agree on some basics so that we're all kind of working together as one front, we'd be far more powerful.
I think the public banking movement has got to be in the regions, really, not in London here, because London has too much power. It's a way of extracting power off London, off the city of London, for us to do our own thing and have a real economy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we kind of argue or feel here is that Wall Street really isn't interested in a lot of the things that you can do with a state-owned bank. They're not interested in our local projects or our local small and medium-sized businesses. So you can almost set all that up without even treading on anybody's toes. You're catering to a market that's not being catered to right now. Well, for example, postal banking.
Don't you think they'll get worried about this better,
model
version of banks, and then they won't get rescued when they gamble wrong next time?
Well, it is a question. I was wondering that about your city of London. I mean, they're so powerful. What hope do we have? But it just seems to me that we have a different flavor to things now, that people are not putting up with what they used to put up with, and they're ready for something new. They're ready to hear about it, and hopefully they're ready to organize and actually do it. But the first step, it seems to me, our job is to show what we're talking about here, why it's a better idea, why they will make more money, why it's less risky.
Well, in the UK, I mean, we could even attract right-wingers in that the SME sector, small and medium enterprise sector, is just not catered for with the four large banks that we have here at all. And that's been in so many reports, that there's a deficiency to lend money to small and medium enterprises. And local public banks are the way to go on that. You know, credit unions can't do that. So many reports now are saying that we need to have local stakeholder banks. So, you know, the time is coming, really, you know.
Yeah, we have the same thing in Ireland, that our government has even gotten, is it KfW, the German bank, to provide finance backed up with some money that the government had. So Germany has a state bank, but instead of setting up a state bank in Ireland, Mr. Noonan, our finance minister, got the German bank to come to Ireland to make finance available for SMEs, but they were going to channel it through our so-called pillar banks. These are the banks that we've had to bail out. But they have no experience, nor are they minded, or do they want to lend to small and medium-sized business. So the money hasn't been getting out there. And this is an issue. And they see that there's no competition from other banks. They were looking for foreign banks to come in, perhaps. But the foreign banks aren't really interested in Ireland yet. So we've been making the argument that we need, as in Germany, the Sparkassen banks, because that's their function in Germany. Why wouldn't we have our own national investment bank still channeling funds to smaller banks that really know their constituency, you know their businesses that they're situated, as in Germany, and have the money recirculating both nationally and locally at different levels. That's really what we'd like to see. But we're hoping, in a way like yourself, that we're under the radar, that we can start with the small local banks in the rural areas where the other banks have simply abandoned. They've left. There's nothing there in those rural areas, and that's why it's very difficult for the politicians not to support it, really. And hopefully that through praxis, through doing it, people will learn that there are alternatives and see the benefits, and in particular that local government that maybe have a role or a benefit from the local public banks then would be able to make the case nationally.
Yeah, well, in England, Corbyn has actually mentioned a National Infrastructure Bank on the KfW model.
But Fine Gael and Labour, when they first got into power, were talking about a National Investment Bank before they got elected. Soon as they got elected, there wasn't a word mentioned again. Something happens. For some reason, a national bank seems to be a bridge too far. It gets stopped, whether it's at European level or American influence or whatever. But it seems to be just too hard to do. Whereas a local public banks, a step up they would see from the credit union movement, but I would see as being importantly different because they're true banks and therefore creating money. That has a chance, I think, and I think that's the way to go. I mean, I'm quite hopeful we might manage to get. What they're working on at the moment, the Sparkassen Foundation and Irish Rural Link, is a sort of business plan for the Midlands area of Ireland. They want to keep out of Dublin and the big cities and to work in... The Midlands is a sort of, it's not high tourist area, it's productive farmland, there's a certain amount of small business there, there's good solid towns, but those towns have lost employment and they've lost young people, and they've lost all credit, the banks have moved out, so they're really crying out for money. And, you know, these are small business people with generations, you know, family businesses, and they can't get the smallest amount of credit, really, to do any expansion. And the economy is beginning to move again. We have a growing economy. Our population is young. Houses have to be built. And we have a strong IT sector and we have a strong pharmaceutical sector. And they, in turn, generate other smaller businesses around them. So the Sparkassen Foundation can see there's great potential in Ireland, whereas Germany is a well-developed economy. There'll never be very quick growth, whereas Ireland has the highest growth in the European area at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting. The whole issue of that we need more money in the economy and that the government should be issuing the money and not private banks is a hot issue right now. And Marie, you're one of the organizers of the local Bradford Positive Money Group, but they have sort of a different approach to how we should get money out there. You're obviously in both camps, so I wondered if you could talk about how you see public banking as being a step further toward where we should be going.
Well, Positive Money reckon we should have a monetary policy committee where a committee of the great and the good decide how much money should be issued. And then, you know, banking should be full reserve banking, but that's not going to provide enough money for small and medium enterprises, you know. So mm-hmm. I think there should be a mixture, and you have to have this local public banking and infrastructure banking. You know, you mm-hmm. have to have that because this monetary policy committee is just not going to work for the small businesses to get credit at all. I think I read somewhere it's okay banks creating money if it's for the public benefit, if it's to provide work, start businesses up, and the profits go back into the public, and they're not into profit maximisation but into generating money locally for the local public benefit, and they're not into just gambling on derivatives, you know.
And as we were talking earlier, the only issue then is interest and where does the interest come from for the businesses to pay back. And obviously you need growth. And when we're looking at a time when we won't be growing because we can't continue growing and using up the resources of the world, it is quite possible for a government to issue money as part of a citizen's income. And that's how I think you deal with the interest problem, which is raised by alternative money theorists often, you know, when they're saying local public banks isn't kind of radical enough, it's not getting to the heart of the matter. But I think, as you're saying, it goes three quarters of the way there. And after that, you need other measures, and a government can create money directly, as Ellen has pointed out, and simply spend it into the economy or give it as a part of a citizen's income.
Yeah, I agree with the citizen's income thing, especially as we get into more automation and robots, because there is not going to be enough work for us to be doing 5 days a week, you know, for everybody. Why should we if there's so many machines anyway? I remember 30 years ago when computers were coming in, we were all talking about all this extra leisure time that we'd be having, and where's it all gone? We're actually working more hours.
One other proposal I saw that looked really interesting was on the Royal Bank of Scotland, the RBS. I guess it's a Move Your Money proposal or a New Economics Foundation.
I think it's New Economics Foundation, yeah. It's owned by the government because it was rescued by the government in 2008, and they keep trying to sell off the shares that they have, but they would make a tremendous loss. And there was a debate in Parliament on November the 5th where the motion was passed that they have to investigate other options first. It was a fantastic debate. And, the Tories were useless, as usual, saying there's no evidence. You know, the evidence says private banking is better, and everyone's tweeting, where's the evidence? What evidence?
Mm-hmm. And that used to be the way it worked, that when you talked about nationalizing the banks in order to rescue them, you would take them over, sort of absorb the losses, sort everything out, and then hand it back to the private sector. But it does seem like the private sector has failed. That's why the thing went bankrupt in the first place. Why not hang on to it as a public asset? That would be great if they really did it. What do you think? Is there a chance? Are we dreaming?
Well, at the moment, because it's been the most evil bank ever, and it's got more and more fines, and even though it's been publicly owned, basically, it's been going mad for profit maximisation so that it can be privatised with the connivance of the government. And it's been scamming local businesses terribly and closing them down. It's been awful. It's been the most awful bank ever, you know, much worse than the other banks, and yet they're actually owned by the government, but not on a public bank mandate. You know, the mandate was to maximise profits so you can get reprivatised. So the thing is that if they sold anything now, it would be a tremendous loss, so probably not going to happen in the near future anyway. And there's growing demand to do something else with it. You know, no, they've got all these branches everywhere. You know, it could be turned into something different. We have no diversification, very little diversification in the banking sector in this country. We just have these huge international private banks that are into investment banking and international stuff, and we don't know what they're doing, you know, not good. They're not interested. They're closing branches in rural areas, you know, they're just not bothered about the people in England. We're nothing, you know, and it's no good, really.
Yeah, we have the same thing. I mean, we had to bail out AIB, Bank of Ireland, and we had to fold Anglo-Irish. So we're left with AIB and Bank of Ireland, and our government is the greater shareholder in both, and yet they act exactly the same way. They're still as well paid as ever, with big bonuses and big pensions, and they're refusing to lend to the general economy. What they're basically doing is trying to trade out of their difficulties by using cheap European money, swapping their old loans for lower loans, lower cost loans, if you know what I mean. They're really not lending anymore. So they're not doing what banks should be doing in an economy. And one problem when you talk about a public bank, people say to you, but we already have two national banks. And I say, no, that's not at all the same thing. They're just banks waiting to be privatised.
I remember Noel saying that the Sparkasse outreach people, they said to change a private bank to a public bank, you have to change the management. It's impossible to change the ethos from profit maximisation and, you know, scamming everybody as much as they can to being a public service, you know, and not having bonuses. The Sparkasse, they They're watching out for people who are very selfish and have no empathy and no guilt and just after money. And they weed them out, whereas the private banks actually promote them because they're the ones that don't care about anybody and just go for the money and make more profits. So it's a completely different type of person gets promoted in a private bank than gets promoted in a public bank. And you can't swap them over. Apparently it's impossible, as Spark has to say. You've got to have new management entirely.
We have a great model in the Bank of North Dakota where those people really are public servants. They're hired as public servants, and their mandate is to serve the public. But, of course, they don't have the option of big bonuses or, you know, that's not baked
into the system. That's very important. No bonuses, no fees, no commissions, no nothing. You're a public servant.
Right.
You just get a salary. I think that weeds out some of the bad types, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in that kind of job.
I just have one other question, just kind of general. I'm just curious how things are going in your areas where you used to have like a great national healthcare service and that was, you know, totally socialized, I guess, and the railroads were publicly owned and university was free for, when I went to University of Leeds in 1965, it was free for students with good grades. I just wondered how your whole system has changed. Do you still have that? And do you wish you still did? And are you hankering after the older?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a great amount of people that want the railways renationalized. Absolutely. There was one line, the West Coast line, where the owner failed, the franchise failed and was handed back to the government. So the government had to run the line for a number of years, and it was the most profitable line and the most efficient line and the line with the most customer satisfaction of all the privatised lines, this one line that was owned by the government. But they've gone and privatised that again. You know, well, they give them franchises for so many years. But what's so interesting about the railway network here is that it is state, a lot of it is state-owned, but it's not by the state of the UK, it's by French state and by the German state, because it's German state railways who've bought these franchises and French state railways have bought these franchises. So, you know, state-owned railways are very bad, but only when it's the UK state that owns them. It's okay if another state owns them. The ideology is so ridiculous, you know.
In Ireland, we still have state-owned railways and we have state-owned water systems. But that's why people are protesting now about the water charges, because under the cover of austerity, they're trying to privatise a lot of those services. Our medical service is half private, half public, and it's the most expensive in Europe, and it's delivering the worst service. Unfortunately, we were better off when we were fully public. And at the moment, we have fees for university, but they're nothing like what they have in the UK. But they're talking about raising the fees and bringing in student loans. And I can tell you there's a lot of opposition to that as an idea. What has happened? Because we had to bail out the banks and we had to take on more debt than any other country in Europe. I think it's 13,000 per head of population we took on in debt, much more than Germany, to save the European banks, essentially. We've had to bring in austerity. And under the cover of austerity, our valuable assets are being sold off. First, our best sites. NAMA was this entity that was set up to take the so-called bad loans, property loans. And they've been selling our best property sites and developed buildings to hedge funds and wealth funds, Blackstone and so on and so forth. And the government is congratulating themselves at having sold these sites at discounts of 50%. And we now have a huge housing problem because they don't finish them, they won't develop the sites, or when they do let out the properties, they're to the high end of the market. So Britain, at least, I mean, you have your own central bank, but Ireland under the ECB is really constrained in what it can do. So effectively, there are carpetbaggers. The wealth funds and the elite of the world are congregating over Ireland because they can see that the economy is picking up. And they're waiting to snatch our assets, property assets, land assets, wind energy assets, wave energy. All of that is more or less water assets possibly as well. They say they won't privatise it, but it's all heading towards that direction.
Well, I saw in the Banking Commission report that just came out a few days ago, you know,
yeah,
8 years later, that the government was absolutely blackmailed by the European Central Bank to rescue the banks, you know, totally blackmailed, which is terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, the money to rescue them should have come from the central bank, which was the
from
European
the
Central Bank. It was a
yes,
terrible
it
central
should have.
Bank.
That's what central banks are supposed to do, and they didn't
yes.
do that. Yeah,
it's awful. I mean, anyway, to go back on your original question, Ellen, the university students here, the fees have gone up to £9,000 a year, and they have to pay that back. But they only pay it back. It's like a tax. They only pay it back when they're earning above the average wage, and whatever they don't pay back just gets forgotten about. You know, they only pay. Mm-hmm. So it's not onerous. It's not hanging over you as a problem. You pay a slightly higher tax once you're earning a good mm-hmm. wage. So it's not
yeah.
quite as bad as it is in the US, say. And about the health service, that's still free for anybody to go to the doctor. It's still free for anybody to go to the hospital and have an operation or anything. That's still all free, free at the point of use. That's the Bible here. You know, they'd have a problem if they put that away. We have to pay for prescriptions, but a lot of people get free prescriptions. If you have a chronic illness, you get free prescriptions. The only thing that they're privatising is they're privatising some of the suppliers providing certain services to the health service that were part of the health service originally. A lot of these US companies are sort of sniffing around a lot, which we don't like, to be quite honest. A lot of these US health companies are sort of rediscovering paying some of these conservative politicians, you know. So, you know, they very much want to get in on it. The conservatives always promise they're never going to nationalise the health service, but we don't trust them. They're not trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And then this trade agreement, this transatlantic trade agreement,
would
stop them ever renationalising, you know, any parts of the of these service providers that they decided weren't being as efficient. And my partner's a medical engineer, but these were always private, the, you know, the people who sold the medical equipment to the hospitals. But he says that the price of the parts are just ridiculous. You know, they'll go after the cheapest machine, but then they'll charge ridiculous prices for a wheel of a, you know, a trolley or something like that.
Creeping privatization. Well, it's been great talking to you both. Girlfriends abroad, I love that.
Yeah, it's great that we're all female.
Great,
it's
thanks.
Fantastic.
That is nice.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Eimear O'Shughrut in Ireland and Marie McCary in England.
I'm Matt Stannard. Today, I'm thinking about how we're all alike. That's pretty deep for a financial podcast, but we've been going pretty deep on this podcast lately. In our last episode, Ellen interviewed Charles Eisenstein, author of Sacred Economics. And like Charles, we're asking questions about how to build financial structures that reflect, sustain, and even incentivize our interconnectedness. Let me try to illustrate how this isn't just a bunch of New Age mumbo-jumbo. In fact, it relates directly to on-the-ground campaigns for public banks all over the nation and the world. In Ireland, several groups and a couple of political parties are pushing for the establishment of public banks based on the very fine German Sparkassen model. Pushback, of course, has occurred from powerful members of Parliament and others who want to keep Dublin a lackey of the European Central Bank, with rates much higher than the EU average. It's scary to resist the European Central Bank in Europe. Look what happened to Greece. But the movement in Ireland persists. They even quote famous Irish radical empiricist George Berkeley, who 400 years ago longed for a bank wherein there are no shares, free from all of the evils of stock jobbing, where the public makes all of the profit and therefore makes good all deficiencies. It's this vision that the Irish must sell to their leaders who are frightened of the EU. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, where the people have lost a lot of trust in city government and where the city has paid far too much money to Wall Street, a careful and conservative feasibility study in favor of public banking was released last month. Sure, it said, a public bank will save the city tens of millions of dollars over a couple of decades, but it went on to say we need everyone, especially the community banks, businesses, public officials, everyone needs to be on board. If you want this bank, you're going to need to build the coalition. Having a good idea is never enough. Then later, in January, the Philadelphia City Council unanimously voted to hold hearings on creating a bank. Again, there's plenty of suspicion to go around in that city. Private finance has wrecked the city, but public institutions have failed it too. Who do you trust? Indeed, one well-known local opinion writer has already expressed skepticism, and there haven't even been any hearings yet. And Philly is truly a city that needs economic democracy, sustainable economic justice, and a public bank. So what's in play here? Insecurity inspires exploitation and extraction. A society based on exploitation and extraction in turn creates more insecurity. An insecurity that becomes ensconced in our very bones, becomes the very fiber of our being. Every significant prophet and moral philosopher has known this. And so we're all instructed in religious texts across nations and cultures and time to be stewards of one another and stewards of the planet. But that very same insecurity makes us forget. And so we build insecure machines, big and small, machines in our minds, relationships, to deal with the insecurity. In the end, we are like the strange, obsessive creature in Franz Kafka's short story, The Burrow, obsessed with contingencies, terrified of losing a layer of protection, insecure about insecurity. 50% of Americans are objectively economically insecure, but all of us are economically insecure in spirit. That is, the rich are insecure about staying rich. Those who are just ahead of the curve are terrified of falling behind. It's not just the poor who are cursed with this malady. It's everyone. And it is everyone, in the end, who must be won over by campaigns in Santa Fe, Ireland, and Philadelphia, and elsewhere for public banks. Not that you have to win over every single individual person, but the small businesses have to be on board, the community bankers, and the residents. You can't afford to pontificate, sanctimoniously moralize, or demonize some part of the equation. And so, if the process seems painfully slow, all the partnerships fraught with divisions, think back to the way insecurity and security functions in our lives. The universality of both fear and hope. Because where the rubber meets the road in a new economy is our shared hope, security, and vulnerability. We've got a lot of work to do. I'm Matt Stannard. Have a great and busy week.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with